I'm Jason Louv, and this is the Ultra Culture Podcast. Today I'm talking to the occult artist Mickey Pellerano, who I've known for over a decade. Mickey has been instrumental in the modern occult revival, particularly in inspiring young artists and creatives in New York and Brooklyn to approach magic as a deeply sincere spiritual and artistic path. His black and white charcoal art reflects classicist and occult themes in a way that's reminiscent of Austin Spare, but infused with much more classical hermetic structure. He's also a filmmaker and performed as part of the band Cult of Youth. Mickey was just in Los Angeles to attend the Printed Matter book fair at MoCA, so he took some time to catch up and have a great conversation about magic and hermeticism as a spiritual path. We ended up getting into pretty deep territory and recording one of my favorite podcasts yet. I'm sure you'll love it. Now, if you enjoy this podcast, please stop by magic.me, my online school for chaos magic, where you can learn about magic, hermeticism, yoga, meditation, and lots, lots more. That's www.magick.me. You can now get a free introductory book and 8-day course on chaos magic there, including video training and meditation, to articles on occult theory, to guided meditations unlocking a magician's mindset, and a whole lot more. Okay, on with the show. Okay, so I'm sitting here with my friend Mickey Pellerano, the very famous occult artist who was just in LA for the Printed Matter book conference, independent book conference, and we've been catching up. We haven't seen each other for a while, but we knew each other in New York, and Mickey was actually one of the first contributors to respond to the call for Generation Hex, and has an essay in Generation Hex, and has since made quite a name for himself with not just his art, but his kind of bringing people together and being central to the New York art and occult scene. So we're in LA and we're catching up. We've just been talking about, what have you been talking about? Giordano Bruno, Rome, Mithraic temples, everything in between, elementals, and well, thank you for doing the show very much.
Thank you for having me.
So, so we share a major interest in magic, obviously, but not just magic, but, you know, the more scholarly and, how would you describe it, you know, in terms of more traditional Golden Dawn, hermetic, thelemic?
Definitely my practice has been informed by, all those things. I suppose you could trace the origins of Western magic as we know it to Greco-Egyptian, Alexandrian, Gnostic, Neoplatonic, things like that. And then there's a lineage, you know, it began there and then extended through the Middle Ages with you had the first Kabbalistic texts appearing in Spain in the 1300s and alchemy and grimoire magic, Rosicrucianism, through Freemasonry, through the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, mm-hmm. the Thelemic currents, chaos magic. So yeah, there's definitely a lineage there and a history of magic that I personally have always found very interesting and beautiful. So I've tried to be as informed and as I can without being too antiquated.
Okay. I'm interested in the, you mentioned the Greco-Roman, or the what was it you mentioned? The very beginning with the Gnostics. I know about the Gnostics. The Greek stuff and like the Greek magical papyri and things like that, I don't really know anything about, and other than like the Bornless ritual and things like that. I'm kind of curious about that because I guess there's maybe been more scholarly effort recently to kind of dig some of that up. But if we can trace magic back to it, or specifically the Western magical tradition back to a Genesis point, what would you say it was and what was kind of going on there?
It's quite cryptic to me as well. What I find most striking is the fusion that occurs, and Rome is full of this. It's actually very rare to see art pieces like this. But sculpture, for example, that fuses Egyptian deities and Egyptian concepts of spirituality, but represented in a European style.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, say statues of Isis or Hermanubis, that is a famous sculpture in Rome that's always really fascinated me. These gods that are fusions of, you know, Anubis or Anubis, mm-hmm. is the Egyptian jackal god, right, of death, as a sort of psychopomp. He was equated with the Greek Hermes. So, you know, they invented this Hermanubis, sort of this fusion god. And it's just so bizarre to see this, what you'd normally expect to be a representation of Hermes, this sort of like togaed figure holding a caduceus, but yet it has this jackal head that doesn't look Egyptian at all. It's very European, and it's really striking to see that. And so I think the Greeks adopted a lot of Egyptian mythology and ritual systems, and Plato touched on it, and the Neoplatonic school that occurred a couple of centuries later drew heavily on the metaphysical aspects of Plato's philosophy, and it's become a cornerstone, I believe, of Western magic and theurgy.
Okay. Yeah, one thing that I've really been realizing only recently as I study more and more and more of this stuff is, like, we have this idea, especially, you know, we have this idea looking back that these things were cut and dry. Like, there was Egyptian magic and gods, and then there was, you know, Greek or Buddhist or Hindu. But I'm realizing as you look back at the ancient world, it kind of wasn't like that. It was kind of all blended together, and gods would migrate from one place to another, and religions would take, you know, borrow from each other. I mean, you can even trace the influence of Buddhism, not just on Gnosticism, but on St. Augustine even. But you know, the gods got around, you know, like they were migrating and took on different forms. And, you know, there's even an idea theory that Ganesh may have been an Egyptian god, or maybe it's the other way around. I don't know, who knows, but so that's fascinating to me. But, you know, in terms of tracing magic back to prehistory, you know, or not prehistory, but, you know, certainly the after the birth of Christ, I'm kind of curious how that got started and what the impulse was, what people were trying to do. You know, we know with the Gnostics that they were, you know, we were talking earlier about the ascension through planetary spheres. And, you know, what do you think that was? Was it like, you know, were people looking at a graded system of enlightenment, or what were they trying to do?
I'm not as educated as I'd like to be on Mithraism, but my recent trip to Rome in the fall really informed me of what a massive force Mithraism really was, and how many temples there were to it, and how much art is dedicated to it. And I learned also that traditional systems of magical grades, I suppose, or evolutions that the candidate goes through in, say, systems like the Golden Dawn or Freemasonry, were being practiced in Mithraic systems. And so a lot of the foundation does happen there. The thing with I suppose Mithraism is considered a Gnostic religion. Am I right? Or,
I'm not sure. I think it was definitely, you know, contemporary, but I don't want to say for sure, cause I'm not exactly sure Gnosticism is fairly hard to define. Maybe
it's true
because the idea is kind of circulated.
Well, I think that Gnosticism can be described, say Elaine Pagels, for example, her books to me illustrate that if you're going to divide early Christianity into two camps, you have ecclesiastical Christianity that functions on a hierarchical basis with, you know, popes and deacons and bishops, and, you know, and knowledge of God has to be distributed down these tiers, right, through these different people down to quote unquote normal people who cannot have access to divine experience without the guidance of these hierarchical church leaders. Gnosticism, on the other hand, shunned hierarchical systems in religion because it emphasized personal experience of divine, and it prescribed exercises and procedures that everybody could work with, so they could have their own experiences of you know, gods or angels or planets or what have you, without the need for a church hierarchy, without the need for it all to be locked up in a papal situation,
you know? Right. Although, I guess to play Demiurge's advocate, I think, you know, as you know, we both have some experience with magic, and the flip side of that is there's a danger to that too, because A, it's easy to delude yourself. It's easy. I mean, you know, we I'm sure both know people or have been people where it's easy to, you know, vibe yourself up into a state where you think that you're some type of special or divine person, or that you're having some type of experience or communication with beings, which may or may not be real outside of your own head. I mean, it's very real within your own head, but, you know, that can cause social friction. And then on the other hand, also, when you're doing it by yourself, it is a dangerous path. It is a kind of left-handed path in a way, because just for the simple reason that you don't have a social support system for the most part, you know, as opposed to, for instance, if you are just in the church, then you go to church every Sunday, you know, you have your, you know, everyone that you know in your community is in the same church. It becomes about, you know, like going to soccer games and, you know, everyone's looking out for each other's kids and that type of thing. Whereas, you know, it takes a rare person to do what you're saying, which is take the Gnostic approach or the left-handed approach and try to seize the bull by the horns. But but there's a lot of pitfalls to that too.
Yeah, I suppose that there are, and that there's definitely risks in, for example, sigil magic is probably where most people start out.
Mm-hmm.
And you could argue that there's risks involved in that, but there's also risks every time you get into a car or every time you get on a plane, you know. So I think it's okay to experience, and it's okay to make some mistakes even with magic. You know, you're not gonna, it's like anything else, something that you can experiment with, something you can work with. Doesn't even have to be ritual magic. It can be any spiritual path that you choose to take. And I think it's okay to experiment and be kind of brave and within reason, right?
Huh.
You don't want to get into territory that you know might be dangerous for you, or that you think might be a little bit out of your league. I certainly try to proceed with caution.
Yes. Yeah. I go slow. I used to go very fast, but now I go slow. I'm curious, but in what you just said, so you definitely make a connection between the Gnostic period or the Gnostic impulse, as you put it, and people doing magic today.
Yes, I do.
Okay. And do you think that's everybody doing magic?
Yes, because I think all esoteric religions, as opposed to exoteric religions, emphasize the individual's practice, right? So Tantra, for example, emphasizes the individual person and his path and his prescribed methods of developing himself and working in his body and evolving spiritually through methods and practices that he carries on himself, as opposed to absorbing, say, a belief system or a fact, you know, like, you know, I know there's a goddess Venus because everybody says so. Well, that's unhealthy too, you know, like who is Venus? What's Venus? It's better to experiment and understand the energy that one might call Venus, because everybody's experiencing Venus, whether you're a magician or not. Everybody has impulses of love and lust and sensibility toward beauty. We all experience Venus. What the magician does is encapsulate the concept of Venus and personify it in some way and find correspondences to that energy that all human beings are experiencing from a little bit more of a analytical or a scientific perspective, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then turns it into a practical system by working with that energy, say Venus, in a practical way, and preparing his body and his mind and his soul perhaps to be a better conduit for the energy we call Venus and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you mentioned scientific, because I definitely feel like, you know, magic is a funny word, obviously, but it really is taking a scientific approach to claims of belief and claims of religion and religious spiritual experience. And I don't mean that in obviously the peer-reviewed science way, because then I'm going to get in trouble, but in the sense of going and doing experiments and seeing what happens. So maybe in an empirical way would be a better way to put it. But and that, I think, is people don't get that when they first look at people doing magic or they first read these books. It's just like, how can you believe this crazy stuff when that's really not what it's about, would you say?
Yes, I don't think it's about belief at all. It's about experience. Austin Osman Spare said that knowledge is the excrement of experience. And it's not what makes magic, I would say, different from religion, is that religion is based on faith. Religion is based on belief. And of course, belief is a very powerful thing. But I don't think we need faith once we start to experience things for ourselves. And once we start to just analyze the way the universe works and the way coincidences occur and things that indicate that there is a spiritual current, that there is an underlying intelligence that unites us all together. And once we be able to feel that for ourselves and experience that for ourselves, faith becomes unnecessary.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think particularly with the Hermetic systems and the Kabbalistic systems, as opposed to just pure chaos magic or some of the lighter systems, what you get is just this sense of the universe is ordered, and it, like, you see the pattern of it. And then it's not even really about, it can be, but it's not always about just doing rituals and things like that. It's just like, you know, if you study 777 enough, or you study the Kabbalah enough, it's just like you understand how everything is put together, you know, and then it's not confusing or frightening anymore. And you see that it's there, you know, for lack of a better phrase, that there is kind of a divine order to things. And then that's like a really cool experience, because you don't really feel so alone in the universe. It's like, wow, no, this actually is, there's an order to this. And then, of course, then you can work with that order, but it's not like trying to control it. It's like you see where the roads are and you can walk on them.
That's very, very well said. That's very true. We're all very familiar how the Buddhist things say that all is one and we're all one, you know, and there's no differentiation between one thing and the other thing, or the knower and the known. So if the universe is a unity and something that's intrinsically linked, everything is linked to every other thing. Systems like Kabbalah are fun and beautiful way of finding those threads between all things and finding those correspondences between all things. And magic is a system of using those correspondences between all things. But I don't think you need to study 777 or Kabbalah or these very, you know, intimidating pieces of literature to have a sense of that.
Okay.
I think that the individual person can sense that unity of all things and can sense the connection between things without undertaking such a Herculean task of mastering 777,
right,
or some other very difficult piece of Kabbalistic literature.
Before we turn the tape on, you were making an awesome point, which was we were talking about the kind of the new magical renaissance, and or rather that people are so interested in these ideas, and that it's kind of, you know, coming up everywhere. And you had kind of drawn an analogy to working out and taking care of one's body, and what was it that you said? Because I want to preserve that, because it was an awesome point.
I guess basically what I was saying is, you know, there's these hard-hitting occultists out there, you know, Aleister Crowley and Dion Fortune, and they can be very intimidating sometimes because the literature is so extensive and so vast, and the magical systems are so loaded with complex iconography and imagery, and I find that beautiful, and I know you do too, and mm-hmm. and we love that. But to me, those people are like triathletes, you know, they're like Olympic athletes, they're big lifters, you know what I mean? But that does and in the world we have these let's take it away from magic and talk about athletics. We have these Olympic athletes, and they're such experts and such, you know, they've dedicated their whole lives and bodies and minds to become these great athletes. But that doesn't mean that the rest of us shouldn't take care of our bodies, or the rest of us shouldn't enjoy playing tennis with our friends, or, you know, playing baseball or going for a run and keeping our bodies strong and graceful and beautiful. So I like that people are getting very interested in magic, and I don't think that they need to necessarily examine these highfalutin dense forms of magic. They can sense for themselves and find their own practice and find their own way of nurturing their spiritual side. I think spirituality sort of has a bum rap a lot of the time. It's unfashionable, or it's fashionable in any given sector or time frame, but like it or not, spirituality is an aspect of who we are. And it's something everybody should nurture, or at least have some understanding of. And I think the tides are changing in a very positive way, and that people are discovering that for themselves and really wanting to find that inside themselves. And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think also, I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier. I think people have kind of been traumatized by organized religion. And you know, for a long time. And I don't think organized religion has a lot to say to people as much anymore. You know, recently I've gotten really into Christopher Hitchens, and kind of I've been, you know, as a magical exercise, you might say, I've been trying to really take on like the most hard-headed atheistic like viewpoints, like Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins, and there's another guy that I love named Dr. Stephen Novella, who runs a thing is called Skeptic Blog or something like that. But, you know, like the most skeptical people, like, you know, the people who are like, nothing is real except for, you know, basically like what material science tells us, you know. And I found that actually like really refreshing and invigorating. But as a magical, you know, exercise, I've been trying to take all this material on and then see myself from that perspective, and, you know, what these people must think of somebody like me. And, you know, that's very humbling and it's dizzying. It's like, I actually had one experience where I was, you know, I'd spent all this time listening to a Stephen Novella thing about pseudoscience and debunking pseudoscience and magical thinking. And I had this moment of almost literal vertigo where I had to sit down and I'm like, what if everything I've ever believed is just foolish and silly and none of it, you know? But I also realized that a lot of what is perceived to be false by modern culture or materialist science or atheistic culture is the excesses of scriptural religion and pseudoscience and magical thinking where it's incorrect and things like that. But at the same time, there really is a lack of, I guess for a better, lack of a better word, of spiritual connection in our culture. And people are, they don't have anything to fill their souls with, you know, for lack of a better word. I mean, and I think a good way of demonstrating that is, you know, when I go to, and at risk of, at risk of I don't want to sound Orientalist or something, or putting some, you know, another culture on a pedestal, because that's clearly not the case. But you really get a sense of, if you go to places like India or Nepal, it's like people are outwardly incredibly poor, just in not all of India, but certain parts of India, incredibly poor, but they have this incredible sense of love and spiritual connection, and some of them, and there's this palpable, tangible, like you can almost touch it, sense of magic being real and spirituality being real, and the connection with the divine, again, for lack of a better word. And then you come back here and it's like, we've all got iPhones and cars, and but people are dead inside, you know, not everyone, again, I don't want to make generalizations, but you know, everyone's miserable. They've got all the material comfort in the world. And it's just like, you know, they're like kids with too many toys who are just like, I'm still not happy. Something's missing. So I don't think that the hard-headed, materialist, atheistic perspective, even though it's been so necessary and will continue to be so necessary for liberating us from the hell of theocracy, at the same time, people are hungry for what you're saying, which is, you know, a direct connection, a Gnostic, you know, more Gnostic approach. And that is dangerous liminal territory in our culture, but is fascinating to me. I don't know, I went on a rant. I forgot how I got on that. But.
Yeah, I think people are healing from that. For all of us, you know, as a human, at least in the West, you know, thinking people have been really turned off from spirituality forever because organized religion has been a destructive and distorted force. And therefore, because that's really all that was available, spirituality in general sort of got a bad rap, and people started seeing it as being impractical or false, as you say, or unmeasurable, and therefore you're not able to back it up scientifically. But if you practice spiritual practice and you make it a part of your life, you will be the scientific proof. You will see that it makes significant changes in your personality and in your surroundings, and can be a very useful and evolutionary tool for you yourself. And that should be all the scientific proof that anybody needs. You've tried something, you've examined its results, that's scientific observation. And if it's worked for you in a positive way, then it's been a successful operation, and it has been scientifically proved.
In the subjective sense, in the sense that it's subjectively meaningful to you. But I always, you know, it's, I always go back to what Crowley says in the beginning of Liber O, where he says that, you know, in this book there are spoken of many things, Sephiroth and demons and planes and all of, and angels, and you know, never make the slip of thinking that this is objectively real. Essentially, it's like, you know, it's a sub, you know, magic provides incredibly potent, meaningful, subjective experiences, you know, internal experiences, in the same way that an intense yoga practice or psychedelic drugs or a major life event, you know, will do for you. But in a very structured and science, as you say, you know, scientific, measured, methodical, empirical way. But I think that the people get into trouble, and I've certainly gotten into trouble by mistaking my subjective experiences for objective reality. Like, I had an experience where I spoke to this being, therefore that's literally real. And this is, I think, the mistake that is at the root of organized religion. Meaning, you know, some desert prophet had an experience that God told him to go, you know, kill a bunch of people, and then that actually happens, you know. So I think that's, I always think that's incredibly important to point out. And I think that, but I also think that my experience with the Hermetic tradition has sharpened me on these issues so much, where many people have muddied thinking on what reality is, you know, from either side of the perspective, the fence, either materialistic or theistic. But I'm curious. You're really talking about individual practice and the importance of making an individual effort for somebody who's maybe not going to go memorize all of 777, or learn all of the Kabbalah, or master, you know, complex, difficult yoga poses and things like this. for somebody who just is looking for a basic connection or to begin working on their spirituality or their connection to the universe, what do you tend to recommend to people?
I'd recommend that they follow their own path, that they keep themselves open enough to see what's out there as far as literature or spiritual practice or anything like that, and whatever it is that they feel drawn to the most, whatever resonates for them in particular, go with that and follow that. I mean, that was my experience. I remember the first time I practiced Hatha Yoga, I was like, wow, this really makes sense to me, you know. And I've never really been a very athletic person or someone who felt very in touch with his body, and when I practiced Hatha Yoga, I was like, this just feels right, you know. And when I've read certain books, I'm like, whoa, this just feels right. So I can't say that there's one good method or practice that I would prescribe universally for everybody to start with. I would just say, if you are seeking a spiritual practice or you are seeking to deepen your spiritual practice, stay open until you find the literature or the practices that resonate most with you and that you feel you can really grow from.
Okay, so yeah, so I feel like there's so many different approaches to magic. You know, there's really like the open approach, the try lots of things approach, the kind of follow your own path approach, and then people tend to not always, but often, if they get more serious, will default to a more structured system. And you know, that could be, you know, yoga or some of the Hindu systems or Golden Dawn, which is one that is obviously both of interest to both of us, but it was just critical in terms of the growth of magic. And you know, before the Golden Dawn, everything was so scattered. And Mathers really, and I don't think he gets enough credit, you know, this one guy sat in the British Museum and put all this stuff together like he was assembling, I don't know, like a circuit board or something like that. Like, it's an incredible feat of technical brilliance. Whether or not it's scholarly correct in a scholarly way, you know, like that, you know, of course the goal, maybe these things don't fit together in terms of Egyptian and yoga and Kabbalah and the tarot and Enochian and geomancy. Like, he fit all these things together into one coherent system that's just not only beautiful, but from which we inherit essentially all magic that's come since, at least in the West. And it's just, it's an incredible feat of work, whether or not it's historically accurate. And I don't think he gets enough credit for that. Obviously, Crowley got a lot more credit and was a lot more visible, but he didn't make any of that up. He essentially just, you know, put his own bombastic personality on, not just, but he took Golden Dawn and then continued Mather's work in a way where he synthesized more things from the Eastern and Sufic traditions. But and you know, Theravada Buddhism with Alan Bennett, but Alan Bennett did that work, Crowley didn't. So all that said, I mean, obviously the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn is fascinating to me, and I think fascinating to you, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on not just on that period of history, but on that system.
I'm not quite certain how much of the Golden Dawn system was the origins of the Golden Dawn system are a little bit cloudy. We're not certain. It seems to be that the structure, grade system, and I don't know, I guess the whole infrastructure of the Golden Dawn was derived directly from Freemasonry.
Yes, yeah, the SRIA, the Masonic Rosicrucians.
Yeah, so they kind of emphasized the hermetic aspects of Freemasonry, because not all Masonic lodges even acknowledge that aspect of it, right? And they put their own spin, of course, Mathers and everybody else, to create what we know now as Western magic, as you said, is pretty much encapsulated by the Golden Dawn and their whole system of grade systems, and what they've incorporated into their curriculum and things like that form a practical current cohesion of what Western magic is. And it's a beautiful thing with beautiful symbolism and regalia. I find it so interesting and glamorous that so many famous people were a part of it. I just read recently, I didn't know this, that Arthur Conan Doyle was in the Golden Dawn.
Was he?
Yeah, the author of the... Well, the Wikipedia page said said I forgot what the term it used, but it said alleged or proven members or something. So he's at least an alleged member, was Arthur Conan Doyle.
Okay.
Famous actresses, famous authors, Arthur Madsen, obviously W.B. Yeats, who's one of the most important, you know, poets. And it was a very sort of glamorous society of interesting people getting into such a complex and well-organized organization that practice very sophisticated and elaborate magical work.
Huh. Although I will say, did you read the Richard Kaczynski book that came out, Portorabo?
Oh, no, I didn't read that one.
That's, to my mind, the best biography of Crowley, although the author is biased, in my opinion, but I think that he really brings out a lot of the details of Crowley's life that have been left by the wayside. You know, he brings it into clear focus instead of the mythology so much. But he talks about, Crowley's take on the Golden Dawn, and obviously he joined later, but the Golden Dawn came off sounding very suburban and parochial in a way. Like, definitely there were these incredibly glamorous, cultural heavy hitters who were in it, like Yeats and Florence Farr and Arthur Machen and Algernon Blackwood. But I think there probably were never more than 200 people in it. And I think a lot of it sounded like, it kind of sounded like furries at a science fiction convention almost. Like, it sounded like people were very it was kind of like weird people who would just were in this thing because it was a way to socialize with other kind of misfits. Which sound, you know, is kind of deflating in a way, but I don't think that when Crowley joined it, I don't think Crowley was too impressed by it when he joined it, you know. But at the same time, and I think that people, but it's tricky to say things like that, because with magic, people build these things up in their head, like they're, oh my god, like this is like, these people must be the Illuminati, and they're the most, you know, these people must be like, you know, or incredibly dangerous, or like god knows what. And then you meet people who are into magic and it's like, oh, you know, like, okay, like this is so like non-exciting and boring in a way, and like kind of stuffy and academic. But that's also a blind, if you will, because underneath the disappointment of seeing often how unglamorous magical people are is the realization that, okay, that's not important. The personalities are not important. Like, what someone's wearing is not important. That who they are as a person, it's important in as much as you can see how much they've evolved through magic from what they had to begin with. But it's not a fashion contest. It's something very different from that. It's, you know, it's a, if it's real working technology, you know, the personalities are kind of incidental. So sorry to go off on that tangent, but the Golden Dawn has this unique, despite all that, has this unique status of being like this, was at the social center of English culture, at the artistic culture at that time, and that there were so many Bram Stoker, you know.
Another one.
Yeah, so many influential people, and that all of the occult teachers, the big occult teachers that came afterwards, both Crowley and Dion Fortune, and and then later on Rigardi, you know, came out of the Golden Dawn stream.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't read that book. I read Do What Thou Wilt. I really like that one.
That one's good.
That Crowley biography. I didn't read that book, and I did read this book called The Magicians of the Golden Dawn by Alec Howe.
Is that good?
Oh my God, yeah, it's great. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how you say that it sounded sort of parochial or suburban, because there are little things in the book that make them all sound silly and things like that. I was like, this would sort of make a great satire, you know? And
like what was in there?
I don't know. Like, there's a section from this one guy's magical diary of how he, how he didn't bring in his wand in time that he was supposed to create, because he's like, because I forgot the paints and I had to go home and get the paints. Like, you know, like little things like that, or like, when they kicked out Annie Horniman for a while because they were mad at her for something, like she wasn't giving them enough money, and everybody in the Golden Dawn was getting together being like, no, Annie Horniman's so great, like she's given so much of her time and all this stuff, and Alan Bennett was like, I will not sign this petition. She is like, you know what I mean? Like just like how everybody, you know, everybody's got their personalities and their flaws and their little idiosyncrasies, but that's what makes the Golden Dawn kind of colorful and fun, and I don't think it could have been a complete, you know, tea and biscuits social hobnobbing group. It just demands too much from you. It demands too much of the candidate. It demands too much work. It demands too much practice and knowledge for it to be just a total, you know,
right,
tea party, is it?
Although, to be fair, most of the practical material doesn't start till Adeptus Minor, so in the Outer Orders, people could have just been kind of coasting along, and I don't know, because it's the same with any of these groups. It's always usually just like a handful of people doing the real work, in my opinion, or in my experience, perhaps. That, you know, there's the diehards, and then a lot of people are just kind of socializing around that core.
Yeah,
but that's fine too.
It could have been. I don't really know the precise order and structure, but I do know that at least the people who were very active in the Golden Dawn, it really meant a lot to them, and it asked a lot of them, and as you said before, we've got to credit the Golden Dawn as being what we know as Western magic now, and I'm excited to see how it moves forward. You know, I feel like the Golden Dawn has been this sort of cornerstone and reference point for magic for so long that I'm curious to see what the next Golden Dawn situation will be, and when we stop drawing from these traditions that are 150 years old, and that I love, by the way. I'm not suggesting we depart from them. I'm just interested in how they evolve and what new ways will evolve, and maybe they will be easier for people to access at a larger scale.
Right. Yeah. Just as a tangent, I probably shouldn't throw this in, but just as a tangent, the all time best for like what we were saying about goofy stories is the book Remembering Aleister Crowley by Kenneth Grant, where it's got all of their letters when Kenneth Grant was like 18 and thought that Lovecraft was writing nonfiction and was staying with Crowley. And there's like stuff in there about like Crowley getting mad at him for like leaving like cookie wrappers around and things like that. It's like, and like Kenneth Grant is always just like, what about the Trans-Yagothian Mauv Zone Cthulhu old ones coming back in through the gate of the neither, you know, Kabbalistic reaches of trans outside the circles of time? And Crowley's like, what you really need is to get a nice suit and a job. Like, you know, you need to, your focus is, you know, you don't ruin your life, young man, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we're all people, and what you were saying before about, you know, filtering your experience, being careful that your subjective experiences don't become super monolithic or whatever. That is true. We always have to be reminded that we're all religions, all mystical systems, all anything, not just magic, is dealing with ineffable things, you know, and all mythologies are just cloaks and poetic and beautiful ways to tell stories about cosmic reality, that things that are not visible, things that are not tangible, and translate them into a way that the human subconscious or the human sensibility for art and poetry can appreciate them and understand them. And when we are practicing magic, we do have to be like, well, I'm a Golden Dawn guy, or I'm a Crowley guy, or I'm a this and that. We just have to be like, look, this is a path that I follow, but it's no more real than any other path. I just particularly am attracted to this imagery. Like, you know, one guy's interested in Ganesha, one guy's interested in Isis, one guy's interested in, you know, some obscure deity from Southeast Asia, I don't know.
Right.
You know, and we get attracted to these mythologies, but we have to understand that, of course, that they are simply mythologies. They're simply ways of cloaking universal, ineffable concepts into ways that the human mind can process them more easily and more tangibly.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important point. They are languages in a way for just understanding like the universe and this crazy thing called life and what it is to be alive and conscious and have to make meaning from this apparently chaotic existence of just you're born and you're like, I don't know what, you're at the mercy of other beings, and then you grow up and then it just, you know, nothing makes sense, and you know, everything is chaotic and crazy and confusing and terrifying. And from that place of confusion and terror and fear, people have made order. It's like the Masonic thing, Ordo Ab Chao, or order out of chaos. You know, it's like people have built these systems of meaning to understand life and their place in it, you know. And it's, everyone does, it's not just magical systems, you know. It's like, look at how people feel about Star Wars and things like that.
Totally.
You know, that's a modern mythology.
Yeah, or even just the way a particular mother will choose to raise her children. You know, she might not be necessarily looking to any religious or mystical system, but she can be doing her cosmic task of raising her children in a very magical way and cleaning her house in a very magical way. And, you know, the children's father can be working in everybody is practicing magic, right? And that's how Crowley, somebody asked Aleister Crowley, well, why should I study magic, practical magic? And Crowley says, well, you're doing it anyway, so you may as well do it properly.
Right.
You know, like, we're all functioning magically. We're all functioning in a universe that is magical and mysterious and full of strange impulses and coincidences and phenomena that and just, you know, people like you and I are just happen to be very interested in the nitty-gritty of studying that, and the
we're just techies, you know.
Yeah, and the beautiful array of mystical systems and pantheons and gods and goddesses that have been created. I think we both find a lot of beauty and poetry in all those things, and we love them. But that's not to say that the quote unquote non-magician isn't practicing magic in their own way. It, as long as they're tapping into their place in the universe and their, you know, karma and their connection to everything else and everyone else, and they're living with compassion and loss of ego, but exercising their own strengths and their own abilities to manipulate reality in a way that they see as evolutionary or advanced, then to me they are practicing magic and they're doing a great thing.
And you're totally right. And I think it becomes easier to see that if you practice magic, ironically. You know, it's like as you enter these spiritual states through whatever, you know, path you use to get there, you just walk down the street and you look at people and you start to see reality from a magical viewpoint, which is one of the things that magic does. You know, you see, you understand that. You understand how a ritual action might not just be waving a magical dagger this way and the other. It might be literally what you're saying, which is, you know, how a, you know, the stories that a mother repeats to her children, or a ritual action is, you know, like, you know, any tradition from any culture, you know, how people party, how people, you know, cook food, you know, like how people prepare food, or anything, like name anything basically, right? And when I got that, it really kind of demolished the whole, you know, all the grandeur of building oneself up as, you know, a high monkey muck, as it were. It was just like, I just realized, you know, it's kind of not the point. It's far off from the mark. And what's really happening is people are just building up. It's almost like in the same way as people can't help but create patterns, you know. They can't help but pattern their reality around them. They can't help but create, you know, overlay meaning on top of things, for better or worse, because sometimes we can overlay, you know, the wrong meanings on things. But so people are, as you say, constantly practicing magic in that way. And there's just a point where that becomes so tangible and visceral and real. And you see that, and, you know, you just go for a walk and walk through your town, and you go through each street and you see how people have built up reality around them, you know. Or you go to a temple from a different culture, or you go to, you know, a restaurant from a different culture, you know, you understand how people, you know, like go to a Greek restaurant, or go to a, you know, like, or go to a Mexican restaurant, or go to any of these things and look at the ceremony and the formalities around things, even if they're not blatant, even if they're kind of sub rosa, just the protocol around things. It's like you understand how things are ritualized. And if you do a lot, ironically, if you do a lot of ritual, you just get sensitized to this. So you get to see it. It makes sense to you. But once I got that, it was kind of like, wow, it was good, but it was like, I'd feel very unspecial now.
Yeah, it's all about making something sacred. It's all about finding the sacred in the mundane. And we were talking earlier, I was so impressed when I went to ancient Ostia in Rome, and, you know, the whole entire city seemed to be just, every single thing they did was an act of worship. If they took a bath, it was a bath in a bathhouse dedicated to Poseidon or Neptune. If, you know, there's a little temple where the cult of Eros worshiped the nymphs and sent them offerings, you know, it wasn't called a tavern, it was called like a holy place of Bacchus. And there's all these Mithraea there with these initiatory mystery schools working there, and it just seemed to me, I was like, wow, this is a culture that every little thing that they did was sacred. Every time they took a drink, every time they took a bath, every time they ate, it seemed to me that they were doing all these things in the spirit of offering it to something higher, offering it to something outside of themselves, something majestic and great, you know what I mean? And you know, I know for me myself, like, I'll roll out of bed and jump in the shower and brush my teeth and this and that. And one of the reasons why, when you get into studying formal magic, they suggest that you take the time before you eat to, you know, to acknowledge that this is a sacred act, or before you do almost anything, if you can stop and realize, okay, this is a sacred act, you know. And when you cheers with your friends, like, think what you're doing, you know. When you share a drink with your friends and you all clink your glasses together, you're like, you know, that's like striking a gong, that's like making a noise that seals the practice as a sacred act of camaraderie, as a ritual among people to invoke like good health or good energy or good whatever it is, you know. And Joseph Campbell, when at one point, I'm paraphrasing, but when at one point when Bill Moyers is like, well, where are our rituals now, and Joseph Campbell's like, what about having dinner with your friends,
right?
You know what I mean? What about making that sacred? What about honoring the love that is all around you, and honoring the people that are all around you, and, you know, honoring food and sex and you know, all these things, alcohol, things that can be vices. We can even take those and make them virtuous, you know, and by an act of intention by an act of saying, no, this is a special thing that I'm sharing with this person or these people, or I'm doing this with the intention of expanding myself in some way or connecting to something larger than myself in some way, even if it's just the collective that's sitting at this dinner table. That's connecting with something larger than you.
Right.
So
yeah, and magic, you know, doesn't have to be complex. You know, it's just making the intention to create meaning around something. In a way, it's that is kind of alchemy, in a way, of turning lead into gold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an apparently random, chaotic, meaningless, mundane activity and making it sacred. And that is, I think, what people are missing in some ways. But that said, you know, because people obviously are often just kind of drifting through life. But that said, I think that what you were just saying, you know, really underlines for me the critical point of, you know, magic didn't go anywhere. Like, people have this idea of magic like it's this big Hollywood thing or Golden Dawn, or, you know, was like, you know, some time in the past where people wore crazy robes and had long beards and, you know, looked into crystal balls and things like that. And yeah, all that happened. But those are just small, specialized instances of what the entire human race is essentially doing all the time. And magic did not go anywhere. It's just, you need to know how to look. You know, it's like you need to look with the eyes of a magician, and a magical practice allows you to develop that. And then once you understand that, then you look at reality through a magical perspective, which is a sacred perspective, which now makes your entire experience sacred. You know, that's the magical path. But yeah, you know, it's like, I can't help but leave the house without seeing, you know, either having some intense magical experience or seeing, you know, the, you know, it's like, it's essentially if everything around you does not look magic, you know, stop and look harder, because it's all there, in my opinion.
Very well said. It's true. And that's what I mean. I think sometimes words like occult and words like esoteric are just that. They're so forbidding, and they're so and in America in particular, I think people who study the occult are like, oh well, you know, I'm in on this secret or something like that, and we're not, you know.
Right.
we just have one way of enjoying it. We have one way of studying it, because we're super turned on by it, and it makes us excited, and we like it. But magic is happening whether you like it or not. I mean, the universe is unfolding in such a beautiful way, and every individual human being has access to that. And I honestly believe that every human being is practicing it to some degree. And all of us, if we're hardcore magicians or we're not, or we feel like we know nothing about this, our task is pretty much the same. And what you just said, find the beauty, find the magic in things that are seemingly mundane and commonplace.
Yeah.
And realize that they're magnificent, and the world is magnificent, and human existence, I mean, gosh, what a gift, you know? So
yes,
if we just think that way, I mean, life can be so great no matter what's going on.
Totally. I want to add one thing that's been super useful for me that just occurred to me when you were saying that, which is incredibly well put, which is something that's been really important for me to realize is magic is something you do. It's not something you are, right? Or being a magician is something that you do. It's not something that you are. It's an activity. So when you're all robed up and doing all kinds of stuff, I mean, that's a certain type of magic that people do. That's an activity. Or magic is, you know, an active thing. It's like what we're doing, that's doing magic. That it's tricky to then slip into I'm a magician and therefore have some type of special status, or not. It's not even that. It's thinking that, it's making the mistake of thinking that there's permanent change, like that there's a permanent shift, or, and in some cases there is, but, you know, it's like, okay, my badge is stamped, I got the degree, I got my Boy Scout badge, so I'm this person now. That's actually turns out to be kind of a not very useful way of looking at it, because no matter who you are, throughout any given day, you shift so much through different realities. I mean, like, if you get up and you're in a bad mood and you're telling yourself a bad story about who you are, you know, oh, I suck, I fucked this thing up, I should apologize to this person, or that person fucked me over, or, you know, whatever, or, I, you know, I'm not as far along as I should be, or, what, you know, like, whatever people are telling themselves, or, you know, I messed up my diet, or whatever it is. That's doing magic, like you're saying. And then maybe 2 hours later, you know, you're in a creative role and you're just like, okay, like, I can feel like I can do anything. And then an hour after that, you're exhausted and you're like, I got to take a nap. And it's like, I'm totally like, I'm worthless, I can't do anything. It's like, it's only halfway through the day. So it's like, we're changing constantly. It's like the Eastern thing of the only constant is change and constant flux. And, you know, the Eastern systems are so on point about how transitory and immaterial everything is. And how transitory and immaterial identity is, and how much identity is an illusion, because identity is really just constantly in flux also. So for me, it's been really important to, and this is a good way out of the ego trap too, I think, it's really important to realize that you're a magician when you're doing magic. And magic is something that you do, but it's not something that you are. It is something that you are in a way, and that you're a magical process, but it's kind of like, it's not like collecting achievement points or like leveling up in Dungeons and Dragons, you know, where it's like, I'm now like a 15th level wizard, so life is just awesome.
Yeah, it's just an aspect of your personality, and all magic and mysticism sort of aim to dissolve the personality. They aim to dissolve these really limiting perceptions, self-perceptions that we have of ourselves, you know. One minute and that goes both ways. One minute you're thinking like, oh, I'm a fuck up, and the next minute you're thinking like, I am a powerful magician. And it's like, but, and both of those things are not okay. You know, like, you shouldn't be thinking either. I shouldn't be thinking either of those things. I should be just doing what my task is at that time, and trying to dissolve any sense of identity and who I am and who I'm better than and who I'm worse than and anything like that. It's just, I hope one day to evolve to the point where I truly can at all times maintain those glimpses I've had of that oneness we described at the beginning of the conversation, and that oneness with all people and animals and plants and stars and planets and everything else. I mean, that's what magic is really about. It's not about who I am or how, measuring myself by my accomplishments or my identity or anything like that. It's just sort of taking those correspondences and finding your place in the cosmic scheme and your connection to all things, and through that really comes compassion and comes self-love, I think, and love for everybody else and appreciation for existence, whether it's in a flux of positivity or negativity or whatever it is, just like loving life.
Yeah, that's very well put. And I think you're totally right about also what you're saying about it just being about participating in life fully and kind of fully showing up. And I mean, even, you know, I was rereading The Vision and the Voice recently, and there's that whole part in there about, in the, I forget which Aether, but the whole bit about the Black Brothers are kind of the people who have taken knowledge for the False Crown, and they're depicted as kind of walking around in black robes and bumping into each other and wondering why nothing is working, and they haven't given up, they haven't just let go and embraced existence and the fact you're never going to figure it out. You know, there's no one really knows, you know, no one's got it sorted out, and no amount of piling up books or having, you know, occult experiences or learning dead languages or, you know, getting merit points is ever going to cut it. You know, it's just stuff. It's stuff of the mind.
That's very true. Yeah. It's just, as you put it, it's a system of living life more fully and showing up more fully and, you know, working to your highest potential, but not getting disappointed in yourself when you don't. Yeah. You know, it's a process, it's a journey, And heartbreak can be beautiful, and failure can be beautiful, and all these other things, as long as they are geared toward higher understanding and evolution of the body and the soul and all that.
Yeah. I met Donald Michael Craig shortly before he died.
Oh.
And he, for those who are listening to this, he wrote a book called Modern Magic, which was sold a lot of copies, and it was very formative for a lot of people, in as much as it tends to be one of the first books that people get when they start learning about magic, and leads things through step by step, and it's kind of like it's written in a simple, easy to understand way. And I was talking to him, and he died of pancreatic cancer, I talked to him shortly before he died, and he was encouraging to me. But one thing that he said was, he didn't really talk a whole lot about magic, but one thing that he said was, let go. That's the most important, or not necessarily the most important, but that's, you know, letting go is crucial. And I think, I was like, yeah. I think anyone who's had an entheogenic experience knows what that's about. But in life too, it's just like, and it's hard to remember sometimes, but my feeling about the universe is it's just magic already. You don't really have to do that much. You just have to show up and be aware of the magical process that's already happening. And in a way, ironically, sometimes the occult practices can take you out of that. Not necessarily, but if you take things too seriously sometimes, well, I don't want to say anything is good or bad, because that stuff is awesome. And but my opinion, my feeling is that, you know, magic is constantly happening for us, not because of us, but for our benefit. And it's just kind of like a matter of showing up and being aware of it and being grateful for it and participating in it.
Yep.
Yeah, so... Ooh. we got cosmic for a second. I wanted to ask you about art, though, and how art relates to everything that we're talking about, and how the artistic process has, you know, how magic has overlapped and interfaced with the artistic process for you, or even if you see that there's a difference at all.
I just asked this the other day. It's such a broad question, how art and magic are related. There's so many layers of how they are, and just, you know, the creative process, making something out of nothing, like Kabbalah, stringing letters and numbers and colors and figures together to manifest something out of nothing, or everything out of nothing, you know. That's a crucial thing for both the artist and the magician. And I in my experience, everybody I know who practices magic tends to almost form an artistic practice around it. And I mean, for real, like, I mean, they make paintings and, or et cetera, you know, or glyphs or diagrams or whatever it is they're doing. They're almost forced into that. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think the reverse is also true, that the artist is forced out of himself to, as you say, tap into the magic that's already happening, tap into the creative energy that's pulsing through the universe, whether you like it or not, you know, and make yourself a vessel for that creative force and that creative impulse. When we artists are at our best, that's what we're doing. We're surrendering, you know, like you said, let go. We're surrendering our own identities, letting this creative force move through us in the way that it chooses. And obviously we've trained our hands or our bodies or whatever to be able to dance or draw or whatever we do in a certain way. But really, those skills, the more they're honed, the more powerful vessel you can be for that metaphysical law that creativity is always happening, and that the universe is a creative more than creative. It's just pulsing with fire all the time. You know what I mean? So when you're an artist and you're at your best, I think it's really about what you said earlier, surrender, you know?
Right. Well, you have I think we keep coming to as mystics properly should, we keep coming to these ultimate points. So, but more practically, you have a deck of cards out, and you have potentially art shows coming up, or?
Yeah, I was just here in LA. There was a wonderful panel discussion moderated by Nicoletta Bayer of Blum and Poe Gallery at the Geffen Contemporary. Wonderful, about art and occultism, contemporary art and occultism, but also at the book fair, my friend Frank Haynes, if you're interested in the occult, Heinz Feller Nihilist, has a beautiful array of zines and prints and things that great artists have put together of poetry and music and magic that are available there, along with a deck of cards that I illustrated featuring some occult tropes for a game called Wolves and Villagers.
Yeah, I just saw them. They look awesome.
Thanks very much. Yeah. And I actually do have a show planned in Los Angeles in the fall.
Uh-huh.
So
okay.
As details of that become more tangible, I will let them be known. So
excellent. And if people want to find out more about you, where should they go?
I've got a website, www.mickeypellerano.com, and I'm also on Facebook and Instagram and all over the place. So
okay.
Not too tough.
All right. Well, that was awesome. That was an awesome conversation. And it seems, but yeah, no, thank you for doing that.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Okay. Thank you for listening. If you dug this show, please stop by magic.me, my online school for chaos magic. That's www.magick.me. Also, please make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and tell your friends about the show. Okay, see you next time.